Welcome to Hot Yoga Radio. It's fabulously springy today, and what I'm going to do is revisit the Matrix, the blue pill, the red pill. This will actually be the fifth episode concerning the Matrix. I think we're in need of an epilogue, as it were. Just to recap the previous involvements with the Matrix. The first one was an introduction, and it kind of mapped out what we were going to do. I think the second one was about the existential dilemma of whether to choose the blue pill or the red pill. It did actually occur to me this morning that Neo could have said, "I'm not having either of those pills," and walked out the door. But there you go, that's another alternative. Anyway, the second one dealt with that, the existential weight of that dilemma, whether to leap into the unknown or not. Second one was about metaphysics, and the resonances between the story of the first Matrix film and the many articulations and varieties of metaphysics found in the philosophical traditions, East and West, I should add. The final one, the fourth one, was about the political ramifications, and I focused on theories of ideology in that one. Now, to round up, what I want to do is attempt a completely different tack and to undermine the premise of the film. And I think I'll call this dissolution of the binaries. Now, as I mentioned right at the outset of the Matrix series, the whole thing seems to depend on an underpinning binary, which is an extremely venerable binary, and it's that between the real world and the apparent world. Now, in the course of the various discussions, we also discern some other binaries in the discourse of the film. We spoke about the ocular metaphor, which makes a big thing of the difference between inside and outside, and it sees the human situation as a matter of data finding its way from the world inside the human being through some kind of interface to there be registered or reflected in a mirror or caught upon some kind of photographic plate or some screen which the soul or the subject can discern. And in the same vein, we have the subject-object distinction, the object being something in the world and the subject being that entity which receives data deriving from the object in some way, ultimately, that then produces perception and knowledge and the ability also to act as a centre of will on the object. So we've got three binaries actually that we brought into play. I mean, we said that real apparent was very fundamental, and it is, but the ocular metaphor was one way we needed to talk about metaphysics. And subject-object, I think, plays into the ocular metaphor, doesn't it? You know, it's built upon on a subject-object devoid. I want to say that we can deal with all these binaries of a piece. I mean, for instance, the camera obscura ocular metaphor, even if it's most simple, discerns between the real world, which is the concrete world that's outside of the camera, that's the other side of the pinhole if you are standing inside the camera. And then there's the appearance, that's the reality. The appearance is the inverted image that appears on the back wall. And you know it's not the real world because it's upside down. And you can't walk about in it. You can't smell it. You can see it. But you can't smell it or touch it or taste it. Whereas if you were outside the box, the other side, you could move around in that real world and engage all of your senses and feel that you are in a concrete reality. So subject object, real apparent, internal and external, do actually come under one rubric. So you have to make allowances for that in what follows. Now, I've already done one version of this and I wasn't satisfied with it because it did appear to conflate those three binaries that I've just mentioned into one without explaining how you could do that. And I hope that you now know that you can do that. Now, there's been substantial effort, certainly in Europe from the 19th century on, to upend the grip of real apparent, or subject object, or inside outside. I think there's been a realisation that our intelligence is bewitched by language, to put it in Wittgenstein's terms, and that the terms that we use to formulate our questions and our puzzles and our perplexities vis-a-vis our situation as human beings apparently thrown into a world of experience unto death, there has come a realisation that the terms that we use to phrase our questions and perplexities themselves determine the kind of answers that we're going to get. Like the answer gets implied in the question. And once philosophers realised this, they had to attach new care to language and attempt to understand it a little bit more deeply than they did, and to call language itself into question, and to call questioning itself into question. And generally, being sort of scrupulous people, there was an attempt to get from under this time-honoured set of binaries. And this is a matter which has loomed very large in the 20th century, with structuralism, post-structuralism, deconstruction, existentialism, phenomenology, hermeneutics, and so on. Each in their own way has had one eye on this problem of the question predisposing us towards a particular answer. And this whole kind of question of the way we phrase questions, the way in which we're perplexed, and the role of language in that matter. And I suppose the first and foremost, in the 19th century, Nietzsche was hitting upon this big style. And especially if you look at the notebooks as well, you'll see that he calls into question this whole matter of language structuring our thought. And this actually is a big theme in Nietzsche, even though it's scattered amongst the writings. For instance, when Nietzsche mentions in one of his later works, I forget which one, I think it might be Beyond Good and Evil, he mentions that that even though God is dead and we have killed him, nevertheless we're not free of the shadow of God, because we are not free of grammar. That's mentioned somewhere in those later works, and more or less in those terms. We're not free of grammar, so we're not free of God. In other words, we're not free of metaphysics. Even though by the time Nietzsche's writing and post-Darwin and after a long development of the scrutiny of ontal theology according to its own scruples of truthfulness. Well, yes indeed, you know, God is dead and we have killed him. In other words, there is no deep suspicion cast over metaphysics and cast over the idea that there can be some transcendent signifier that guarantees everything for us, that guarantees our moral codes, our theories of knowledge, our ideas of salvation and human flourishing, our ideas of what happens after death and so forth, our ideas of origins and all this. And that this, all of this stuff is perhaps embodied in language, embodied in the subject-predicate structure of Indo-European languages. I mean, Nietzsche does mention other styles of language, styles of language are not so keen on the noun, and in which everything is process and so forth. And how we would actually, in some kind of sense, ask different questions if we were naturalised into such languages. So, it's in this vein that Nietzsche puts a question mark over the real and apparent world. And the way he does it is through a genealogy of the distinction. He tells the story of the distinction over time, from pre-Socratic times, perhaps, right the way up until to the present. And he notices that, what I'm alluding to here is a passage of probably under a page, certainly only a few hundred words, in Twilight of the Idols, which Nietzsche entitles How the Real World Finally Became a Fable. And Nietzsche traces this through from the original idea that that we understand reality as that which a sage understands, and we have the notion of the sage as the one who himself becomes the truth through some kind of self-refinement. And this passes through various stages. It, in the late 18th century, it comes to Kant, in which the real world is Königsbergian, pale and Nordic, to quote the man. And this is to do with Kant's idea that the world outside of the camera obscura of the human being is the noumenon, and that it's actually unknowable. We only ever know the phenomenon. We only ever know the image that's produced after some kind of interaction with the organism at the interface between the inside and the outside, and a little bit more inside the interface. And that because all perception depends on this process, and all judgment and all knowledge depends on this process, that the noumenon is unknowable. It's completely unknowable. And it, some people think it performs a function in the Kantian schema of a placeholder. Because basically, you know, it's pale and Nordic and Königsbergian. Real world's actually almost disappeared. It's just that we need some notion of something originating the world of our experience, which is structured through the space-time spectacles that we wear, and through this process of making the world understandable that occurs inside us, at the other side of our eye, at the other side of the pinhole in the camera obscura of the human self. And I mean, subsequent to Kant, you know, there's various attempts to criticise Kant's monumental and difficult work. One of the foremost critics, of course, is Nietzsche. And it's quite bewildering when you hear people call Nietzsche a neo-Kantian, and you can tell they haven't done their homework when they say that. But for Nietzsche, you know, the final stage of this dissolution of the real apparent binary is, well, he says, Incipit Zarathustra. That's what he says. In other words, hello, mate.
Hello, Max, come on.
Hello. Hello. Friendly little dog there. Where was I? Oh yeah, the last fire according to energy, incipit Zarathustra, we are cheerful again. And that means, you know, Zarathustra begins. So the philosophy outlined in Nietzsche's strange mythical work, the Allgemeine Sprache Zarathustra, has now been announced, and that this is a philosophy that doesn't rely on real apparent. It has different questions, it has a different agenda, and its agenda is affirmation. Affirmation. How can we affirm life? In the face of the death of God, in the face of the collapse of metaphysics as an organising principle for everything that is supposed to matter. And of course, on the back of this distrust, or question mark at least, that's now hanging over language. I mean, and the scene is set for the 20th century then, you know. Bear in mind, Nietzsche died in 1900 and stopped writing in 1888. So there's one attempt by giving a genealogy, an historical account of the role of the venerable binary real apparent throughout the philosophical tradition, and done in a wonderful poetic way by Nietzsche in just under a page of incisive prose. And it really is the most remarkable passage that I'm talking about. So there's one way in which the blue pill and the red pill stop posing a question for us. There's one way in which we've, by dissolving the binary, we've dissolved the question. I think the other thing that Nietzsche wants to take a pop at is the verticality of one of the structuring metaphors of thought up until Nietzsche's time. And that's a binary which places the real world above in terms of value, the apparent world. It gives the notion of the real world this ultimate value, which means that the world that we actually live in, concrete, apparent world, and Kant has told us it is an appearance, because we can only perceive as human beings, you know, perception is dependent upon the being, the creature, the entity, doing the perceiving. And so we have this table of values which on Nietzsche's take defames and denigrates and disvalues the world that we have to actually live in, and that this over time has become a rather ghastly life negation. And Nietzsche sees his task as actually polemically upturning life negation as a cultural force, eventually, or at least for some people. Not for everybody. And I think that is a binary that I'm in full sympathy with the task of doing away with it. Even though I'm not wanting to say that what we've got is all surface, which seems to be a postmodernist trope that has arisen out of this very Nietzschean distrust of the vertical metaphor and of a high value attached to an unrevealed real world, and low value attached to the apparent world, which is actually the world we live in. The world we are, actually, as Nietzsche calls it, the world we are. And that's why I'd ask you to scroll back through the podcast and listen to a podcast called Jam Roly Poly, which deals with the fact that there are different strata in existence available to us in experience, in the world of our own experience. We can have mystical experience, we can have psychedelic experience, we can have dreamy experience. And it makes it appear as though existence is layered. And I would say there are layers in our experience which give us the notion of a layers in existence. But layers, not levels. This is not about high and low. This is actually, you know, on my part, a call to change the metaphor from a vertical axis into a jam roly-poly. In other words, complex topography has yet to be determined, or perhaps already partly determined by researchers and psychonauts and meditators and philosophers and poets. And that we also need to be pretty suspicious of like the kind of postmodern Deleuzean flatland as well. So maybe the blue pill, the red pill, the green pill, maybe a whole smorgasbord of pills is there on the table for Neo. And looked at like this, the blue pill, red pill question becomes one of, actually, of just deciding whether to cast some suspicion over the received, unquestioned consensus reality or not. This is what the question then becomes. It's not a question about entering the real world over and above the apparent world, but a question of deciding whether to be open to experience or not. Anyway, a bit further down the line, as I said, the whole 20th century is engaged with an attempt to dissolve the overarching binaries, particularly real apparent, but also subject, object, inside, outside. And it's also, there's been a fair bit of rearguard defence against Nietzsche's attempt to dissolve it. And I think, you know, religious fundamentalism is that attempt. It is actually a rearguard reaction from a position which is becoming increasingly untenable. So it's not like everything's moving forward towards the sunlit uplands of incipit Zarathustra, unhindered. No, it's not. You know, there's struggle, there's turmoil. A lot of it acted out on the plane of blood and flesh and concrete and human affairs. Building on Nietzsche's work, Heidegger had a go at subverting these primordial binaries, and that whole concept of Dasein really attempts to do that. And actually, Heidegger is picking up Husserl's attempt to find somewhere where we could start doing philosophy again after everybody's starting to see through the metaphysical projects underpinned by these venerable binaries. Also notable is Wittgenstein's attempt to help us to escape from the bewitchment of our intelligence by language, by means of language. And Wittgenstein means there that we use language to get out of the spell of language. Wittgenstein's project is a therapeutic one. He doesn't wish to solve the puzzles which perplex us, even though the early Wittgenstein believed that he had solved all the problems of philosophy. And later he thought, oh, hang on, a bit premature. And his work took on, in the second phase, the older Wittgenstein, the Wittgenstein of philosophical investigations, took on the project of helping the fly out of the fly bottle. In other words, of dissolving the conundrums and perplexities that have come to us through the type of language we use and through the way we use language and through the inheritance of a millennia of philosophising and millennia of social organisation governed by ontar theology. So, philosophy is therapy, eh? And one of the chief arguments, it seems to me, that Wittgenstein employs, that particularly takes a stab at dissolving the inside-outside, the subject-object division, which of course is a variant of the real apparent division, is in a passage in Philosophical Investigations known as the private language argument. And in this, Wittgenstein asserts that there is no private language. Because language needs community for its terms to be rooted. A purely private language wouldn't be able to ground or root or fix any of its terms. They would drift too much for the language to be serviceable as a language. And in any case, let's just get common sense about it. You know, language is about communication. Languages are shared by communities, real languages. I mean, even dead languages, Latin, Sanskrit, Attic Greek, are shared by communities of scholars. But certain real living languages are massively enmeshed with institutions. Institutions that attempt to take care of the language. You know, the French Academy does this. Institutions that compile dictionaries and academic institutions which study the shifts in the language and and the way a particular language might have developed, or the way it's fragmented into dialects and so on. And Wittgenstein's sort of right to insist, you know, that language is shared. Now, there's a lot of argument about the private language argument. Even right down to, well, what the hell was he going on about? And isn't it, I have to say, pretty gnomic section in Philosophical Investigation. Not particularly long, but you come away scratching your head thinking, what the hell is he on about? So just bear in mind that there's a lot of controversy about what he was on about, what the nature of the argument was. I've even again heard people say, you know, that this is like just a neo-Kantian thing that's going on here, and I kind of very much doubt it. And what it suggests to me is that Wittgenstein's pointing out, and he's literally pointing, you know, showing and not saying. But he's then, you know, he shows but doesn't say. Of course, you can't say, but you can show. And putting it crudely, we are being offered a picture. We're being shown how we can see our situation as one in which inside and outside are straddled by language. Language exists inside and outside. Of course, we can dream and have conversations in dreams. We can talk to ourselves. We can do what I'm doing here, you know, compose philosophy and only indirectly talking to anybody. I'm just walking along like a nutter talking to myself. But also, the whole thing dependent on a community. The whole thing of language having this purpose of communication for all sorts of practical reasons, but also for aesthetic reasons, spiritual reasons, entertainment reasons, for the sake of poetry, for the sake of lovemaking, as well as for the sake of organising how to produce bricks, or how to dig a canal, or how to cure a disease, etc., etc., etc. the whole business of language being language games, of which there are thousands or millions, and which are open to fresh invention. We can invent new language games. I think a whole load of new language games have been invented around the new technology that gave rise to the need for them to be invented. So language is inside us and outside of us. It straddles the divide. And seeing ourselves as linguistic creatures, primarily, of shifting the focus of inquiry from imaginations about the structure and position of human beings embedded in a world, we shift that focus of trying to figure out what that is, which tends to come down to metaphors like the ocular metaphor, the camera obscura metaphor. Away from that metaphor to the idea of language straddling the divide of inside and outside being nowhere near as significant as we thought. And of course then philosophy takes on a linguistic turn, and I've already said, you know, this is prefigured by Nietzsche, and he thought the way to work it was partly to understand grammar and the enmeshment of grammar with ontotheology, notions of God, notions of transcendent signifiers that reassure us about everything we need reassuring about us as quivering human beings, but also through this idea of giving a genealogy, of giving an account over millennia of how these primordial structuring binaries have arisen, of how blue pill and red pill has arisen, which of course gives you a different perspective. You know, it makes you think, well, maybe this is not as fixed as I thought it was. I mean, Nietzsche does a good job with that genealogy of the real and the apparent, of showing us that, well, it's not as fixed as ineluctable as we simply presuppose without much reflection. And it's difficult to underestimate the importance of that shift. So, I'm going to try and, I mean, this is very diffuse, it's going all over the place, and there's a half a million word treatise implied in all of this, if anyone had time and energy to do such a thing. So all I managed to give you is a bit of a rough outline, but I mean, just recapping there, you know, the real apparent binary that structures the first film, The Matrix, and which has these kind of bedfellows, the subject and the object, and the inside and the outside, in a world, outer world, is actually one that's come under a great deal of suspicion, and I've outlined, I suppose, two and a half of them. Firstly, to say that Nietzsche, through a consideration of language and through a consideration of the genealogy of all of our big ideas, and through an attempt to evaluate our values, you know, Nietzsche attempts at the re-evaluation of all values, you know, particularly the high-low, the vertical axis. So through those means, Nietzsche has called into suspicion the very premise of a film like The Matrix. And I mentioned Heidegger and Dasein, and Heidegger's effort to run with Husserl's belief that philosophy and culture was at a stage that we needed to return to the things themselves, as he called it, which I take it that we return to felt lived experience. I think this is precisely what Nietzsche meant when he said that our current phase was summarised by the little phrase "incipit Zarathustra." And then also Wittgenstein's therapeutic efforts to actually dissolve the conundrums. And Nick Wittgenstein is very explicit about this. We don't solve these problems, we dissolve them by seeing how they arose out of features of language itself. And thereby for us to get some peace. I mean, Wittgenstein did speak about what a blessed state it was to be able to do philosophy, but to be able to stop when you wanted to. Yeah, to take away the itch, because, well, you could just stop, because you could dissolve the problems in many cases. So where does that leave us vis-a-vis the politics, I would say? You know, if the wool isn't being pulled over our eyes by the mongers of ideology, and those who profit by our bovine acceptance of everything as though it was the natural order, how does the dissolution of the real and apparent world affect that project? And I think it is the most important political project of our time, you know, one outlined by Marx in his original primitive ideas about ideology. And I think the clue there is that we need to recognise that the dissolution of real and apparent doesn't mean to say we suddenly live in a flatland. We don't. We don't live in a flatland. But we do live in a world in which the true beauty and sublimity of the world is immediately apparent, should we let it be. It just requires a certain openness on the part of the individual. But also to realise that the world, at least as we experience it, if not levelled, if not arranged into levels of high and low, of more valuable and less valuable, but is arranged in a complex topography of layers. I mean, even just simply on the level of science, where the layers are composed of orders of magnitude. For instance, you know, astronomy and cosmology deal with this, the enormity of the cosmos, of galaxies and solar systems and black holes and so on, and this enormous scale. But right down to particle physics, where we're dealing with minute scale. Scales where even electrons are like as big as Jupiter, relatively speaking. And as well as orders of life, you know, biology is concerned with the organised processes of living organisms, and particle physics with particles. Hydrodynamics with the movement of fluids, and so on and so forth. So, also within our own experience, we meet layers. You know, there's the psychedelic experience, meditative experience of various types, dreams. The way the world looks when one is depressed, the way the world looks when one is elated, and so forth. What the world looks like through the eyes of a lover. What the world looks like through the eyes of a warrior, and so on. We're in this kind of layered, multi-perspectival situation. If we remember that, the politics of exposing and dissolving the effects of ideology are very much alive and well. And in fact, I think we are better equipped to do that work without the vertical axis, without hierarchies of value that are based on theological fantasies. And for that reason, the film The Matrix, I think, as well as for its wonderful comprehensive essay that the first film is on the philosophical traditions and the conundrums that arise out of its core underpinning conceptual binaries, and so that is the value of the first Matrix film. Is that it does rub our nose in that kind of political question, even though it's phrasing that political question in terms of the history of philosophy up until the time in Nietzsche. And he does a wonderful job, actually, of being this sort of artistic essay on that very history and on the role played in it by certain fundamental conceptual binaries. Anyway, that's what I got to say. I'm sure it's kind of pretty diffuse really, but there it is. And thank you for listening if you got this far.